Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
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 Shrimad Bhagavatam 11th Canto, Chapter 22. Elements of Material Creation, Text 34.
Atma Parigyana Mayo Vivado.
Atma Parigyana Mayo Vivado.
Yas Titi Nas Titi Vidarta Nishta. Yato pinaivo parameta punsam.
Yato pinaivo parameta punsam.
Matha paravritta dhyam svalokat.
Matha paravritta dhyam svalokat.
Atma.
Atma.
Of the Supreme Soul.
Of the Supreme Soul.
Aparigyanamaya.
Aparigyanamaya.
Based on lack of full knowledge.
Vivada.
Speculative argument.
He.
Indeed.
Asti.
This world is real. Iti. Thus saying. Na asti. It is not real. Iti. Thus saying. Vida. Material differences. Artanishta, having as its focus of discussion. Vyarta, worthless. Api, although. Na, does not. Eva, certainly. Uparameta, cease. Umsam, for persons. Mata, from me. Paravritta, who have turned. Dhyam, their attention. Svaloka, who am non-different from them. Translation. The speculative argument of philosophers. This world is real. No, it is not real. Is based upon incomplete knowledge of the Supreme Soul. And is simply aimed at understanding material dualities. Although such argument is useless, persons who have turned their attention away from me, their own true self, are unable to give it up. Purport. If one doubts the existence of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, one will inevitably doubt the reality of the Lord's creation. Thus, without understanding Lord Krishna, mere argument and debate over the reality and non-reality of the material world are useless. The material world is real specifically because it emanates from the supreme reality, Lord Krishna. Without understanding the reality of Lord Krishna, one can never definitely ascertain the reality of his creation. One will always wonder if he's actually seeing something or merely thinking that he is seeing it. This kind of speculation can never be resolved without taking shelter of the Supreme Lord and is therefore useless. The devotees of the Lord are not inclined to such argument because they are factually advancing in spiritual enlightenment and are fully satisfied with their progressively more beautiful experience of Krishna consciousness. Om Ajnanatimirandasya Jnananjana Shalakaya, Chakshun Militam Yena, Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha. Jai Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhudintananda, Sri Advaita Gadadha, Sivasavi Goa Bhakta Brinda, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Let us consider that our situation in this material existence is due to a lack of knowledge. This is embarrassing to think, because we like to consider that we are very competent, we are very well informed, well trained, with lots of work and life experience. To think that our situation in material existence is because we lack full knowledge, we lack full skill, we lack competence. This is embarrassing, but that is the actual fact. The spirit soul, part of Krishna, the Supreme Soul, has become overwhelmed by the nescience potency of the Lord. This is why it's important for us to understand the energetic situation, the energetic realities. It is very good for people to acknowledge the existence of God, the existence of the Supreme. But where do they go to understand the energies of the Supreme? In Bhagavad Dharma, we understand that Krishna has multifarious potencies. Parasya shaktir vividaiva shruyate. And we are one of those multifarious potencies. One potency of the Lord can become overwhelmed by another potency. That's the way it is. Therefore, although we are the superior energy in that we are spiritual, as spirit soul, we have become overwhelmed by another potency of the Lord, the nescience potency. Ordinarily, that shouldn't happen. But by Krishna's arrangement, it can happen. By Krishna's arrangement, the inferior potency of the Lord can appear to overwhelm the superior energy, the living entity. Because that happens, the living entity is known as marginal. Just like the beach is sometimes covered by the ocean waves and sometimes not. Why is it that Krishna has allowed such a thing? Why has Krishna allowed the living entities who are spiritual, who are qualitatively as good as Him, why has Krishna allowed these conditioned souls to become overwhelmed? That is Krishna's prerogative. It's a humbling conclusion for us to accept that we are not as powerful as Krishna. Therefore, we can be overwhelmed. We can be bewildered at any moment. For an aspiring devotee to understand this is very sobering. When we understand our precarious position in material nature, therefore, we are always advised to take care, be careful, watch your back. Like you're walking down a dangerous street at night, you're always looking over your shoulder, watching your back. What could pop out of the shadows? It's like in South Africa, where I visit sometimes. Devotees have to be ready that when they are driving a car on the street at night and they stop at a red light, someone can just come right up to the car window with a gun and say, okay, hand over the keys. It's quite common. So they're aware. They don't stop for red lights. That's an adjustment that is made taking into account the atmosphere, the situation. So what are the adjustments we have made to take into account the precariousness, the danger of material existence? Are we armed just with a religious belief in Krishna? Or are we armed with practical spiritual techniques, practical spiritual technology? The Krishna Bhakta learns spiritual engineering, how to exist as spirit soul within the material atmosphere. In other words, our original predicament, our original problem in material existence is caused by a lack of knowledge. We've been overwhelmed due to a wrong choice. Krishna has let it happen reluctantly, just like a parent reluctantly allows his children, her children, to do things that the parent doesn't approve, but the parent realizes, what can I do? I've tried my best to raise the children properly. Now they're just going to have to learn a few lessons. I've done my best, and I have my own life to live. So reluctantly, Krishna has allowed us to receive the results of a wrong choice. We began to consider, Krishna is nice, but I wonder what it would be like to imitate Krishna. I wonder what it would be like to do something else besides serve Krishna. Probably you can catch yourself from time to time thinking like that, even in your present situation. All right, devotional service is nice, the community of devotees is nice, but I wonder what it would be like if I just did something else. So that mentality shows you how we originally got into trouble. Another example given by the Acharyas is, we were working for Krishna's business and we decided, I can do this. I can open up my own business, the same line. The same field of business. I can do it also. I'll just take all I've learned from being a harmonious part of Krishna's business and I'll open up my own business. So the material world is the place where you open up your business for imitating Krishna. But how have the results been? It's amazing. Our pride in imitating Krishna is so great, yet we fail to see how hard we have to work just to carry out that imitation. Remember Pondraka in Krishna Leela? He was so absorbed in imitating Krishna. He actually sent a letter to Krishna. Give up the false carrying of your emblems of Vishnu. I'm the real thing. Give up your pretense. Stop trying to present yourself to people that you are Krishna when everyone knows I am Krishna. What happened when Krishna saw Pondraka in battle? Krishna was actually impressed how vigorously the demon had tried to imitate him. It was laughable, but at the same time, Krishna was impressed. He's really worked at it. So that is the nature of our material existence. We really work at imitating Krishna with determination. So the bhakti process is meant to very skillfully wind down that imitation. Gradually. Most persons don't want shock therapy. You don't want to be shocked overnight into understanding. You mean I'm not the enjoyer? I'm not the controller? All right, I can begin to accept that I'm not the body, theoretically. But now you're telling me I'm not the enjoyer and controller, and you want me to accept this all at once? That's too much. My life will be disrupted. How will my finances go on? How will my family go on? Can you feel that fear of the shock therapy? I'm not the enjoyer. I'm not the controller. Oh, no. We start to think, all right, I don't mind understanding that we're not the body. As long as we can realize we're not the body, we're spirit soul, and still be the enjoyer and controller. This is Mayavad. Mayavadis understand they're not the body. That they are spiritual. But they think that their spiritual capacity is the ultimate. There's no supreme controller. There's no supreme enjoyer. So we have to watch out for unconscious Mayavadi impersonalistic tendencies. Bhakti Yoga does allow for the gradual therapy, the gradual coming out of illusion.
The fear that we have that things will be too abrupt, this is our own self-created paranoia. As we gradually acquire knowledge of Krishna, the chains of material existence begin to slide away. While we're gradually recovering from our greatest mistake, we should be careful. Just like as we were saying, if you're walking in a dangerous area, you're careful. You look over your shoulder. That's part of existence in this world. It's a dangerous place. So why is it that when we take up bhakti, we think, I don't have to be careful? So let us consider some information given in this chapter. Elements of material creation. Krishna is explaining to Uddhava this knowledge. Krishna here is talking about speculative philosophers, always arguing, this world is real. No, this world is not real. Krishna is saying all these arguments are based on incomplete knowledge. Because if you don't understand the source of this world, you'll have a very difficult time understanding this world. You'll see it all as detached from the supreme source. And therefore, you're actually not looking at this world properly. That is the story of material existence. We're not looking at the world properly. We're perceiving wrongly. Like someone with criminal vision, they just see opportunities to steal and plunder everywhere. They see opportunities to bribe government officials, bribe the police. That's all they see. How have we received this perverse mentality? It's because we don't connect the energies of this world with the Lord Himself. Even if we accept there's a spiritual energy. You meet many people these days who talk about just tap into the spiritual energy. Just connect with the all-pervading spiritual energy. Feel it. But they don't connect whatever they're talking about to the Supreme Source, especially to a Supreme Proprietor. Criminals don't want to see the proprietor of something they're trying to steal. If your house has ever been burgled, you know that burglars, they want you not at home. They want, in fact, they like to think that you as the owner don't exist. That's why when burglars are interrupted doing their work, they're very upset. They're shocked. Sometimes they kill people. What are you doing here? I'm stealing. You're not supposed to be around. And they can become violent. Therefore, homeowners are advised that if someone is burgling your house and you catch them in the act, don't try to stop them because you may lose more than your possessions. You may lose your life. So, with our criminal mentality, we don't like acknowledging that there's a supreme proprietor of all the energies. We'll admit, in our best moments, there's a spiritual energy. We're not the body. There's an all-pervading spiritual energy that we should connect to. But we don't like to acknowledge the proprietor of that energy. Therefore, we get lost in constant speculation, theories. Is the world real? Is the world false? Once you understand the source of the world, which is real, then obviously you'll understand that the energy emanating from that source is real. Even though it's a dream, it's a real dream. So Krishna is saying, although such argument is useless, persons who have turned their attention away from me, their own true self, are unable to give it up. Of course, at this stage of the age of Kali, it's not that most people are going to spend their whole life wondering, is the world real? Is it not real? At this stage of the age of Kali, everyone simply absorbed themselves in making money to please their senses. The world may be real, the world may not be real. Where's the money for pleasing myself? And of course, not just pleasing myself, but I am very charitable, pleasing my family and loved ones.
And hopefully the rest of the world will be okay. That's the vision for Kali Yuga. It doesn't extend very far at all. So, we get information in this chapter about how it is that the mind becomes so absorbed in the body. This is very important information. Just like someone studying IT. We shouldn't shy away from this knowledge. We shouldn't shy away from thinking about it. It does require some thought. But we all want to be known as competent. We want to be known as having skill. So this chapter is imparting skill. There is the mind. The mind is shaped by karmic activity. Therefore, the mind inhabits the material body. The material body is the gross vehicle for carrying out the karmic influences that the mind has inherited. In fact, the gross body is the template for the subtle body. Or is it vice versa? Upon the template of the subtle body, the gross body is formed. Yes, belief becomes biology. That is the point. So, why is it you cannot remember your previous life? It's because what you call you is an illusion, a mind that has absorbed itself in the sense objects of a particular body. So when those sense objects are suddenly yanked away from the mind by death, the mind thinks, that's it, I'm finished. Because the mind has been totally buried in sense objects of a particular body. So then, what happens? You're put in another body, and that body has sense objects surrounding it, which you totally identify with. So therefore, what do you think? I'm alive! It's all based on the mind becoming buried in the sense objects. When the mind's yanked away from the sense objects of the old body, you think that's the end. That's why you can't remember your previous life. Because the things that were so dear to you in the previous life are gone. The sense objects of the previous life are gone. Therefore, there's nothing to remember. Well, to speak, of course, of the shock of childbirth. We were watching at one of our programs yesterday. We showed childbirth, the child being squeezed out of the womb. Just that alone is enough to cause you to forget. But also, because your sense objects, your beloved sense objects of the previous life have been taken away from you, there's nothing, conventionally, materially speaking, for you to remember. But suddenly, in your new body, after you take birth, new sense objects, and you feel, I'm alive, this is it. So just see how our existence is perceived by us simply in reference to sense objects being there, being taken away. So the karmic influences work on the mind, and then the mind accepts a particular body. It's interesting that in the Bhagavatam, as well as in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna specifically says, this is a difficult point for people to understand. They're accepting one body and giving it up to accept another. It's difficult to understand. Now we may say, oh, we've heard it so many times. Dehi no smriyata dehe. We've learned in Bhakti Shastri. Now we're on to Bhakti Vaibhav. So what's the big deal? Of course, that you have Bhakti Shastri and Bhakti Vaibhav, you're very fortunate. Krishna says, these points are difficult to understand. Think about it. Well, how is it difficult to understand the process of giving up one body and taking another? It's because the illusory energy makes you think just one frame of the film is all there is. In fact, people, they have so-called philosophy like that today. Just be here now. Meaning, just become focused on the one frame of the film, your present body as it is now. And they tell you, you have to be like that if you're really going to be happy. You've got some problems in life? Here's what you do. Just become still. Deep, breathe. Breathe deeply. Become still. Breathe deeply and just be here with the present moment. All your problems are solved. It's no wonder that Krishna says it's very difficult to perceive this ongoing process of accepting bodies and giving them up. In this chapter, Krishna gives the example of a candle flame. He gives the example of waves in a river, and he gives the example of fruit developing. You look at a candle flame and you think you're just seeing one candle flame. You're seeing it as it is, the candle flame. But actually, the flame is constantly being formed by the wax burning. But you think, I'm looking at the flame. So similarly, we think, I'm looking at the body, me, the body. And when we say the body, we also mean the mind. The mind has become absorbed in the body. Krishna gives the example of waves in a river. You look at a river that's flowing, not a still river, but one that's moving and has a current. You think, I am seeing this spot in the river. But actually that spot is always changing. Similarly, this body is always changing. Or you look at some fruit and you think, I am seeing the fruit, the apple. But that apple is constantly undergoing a process of growing and deteriorating. In this way, the Bhagavatam is training us to see the fluidity, the flow of material life. Of course, sometimes people say, just go with the flow. But they don't understand what that flow is all about. When they say, go with the flow, they're meaning, let nature's laws act upon me. But that's not human life. Human life is meant for rebelling against the laws of nature. That's the real occupation of a human being. Because the mind is so absorbed in the body, you experience all the reactions of the body as you. So what is powerful enough to break up this love affair between the mind and the body? We need to consider that. It takes a career orientation, a career focus to deal with these techniques. But what else is there better to do in life? We are explained in the purport. The purport explains to us that devotees of the Lord aren't just arguing about whether the world is real or not. The devotees of the Lord are factually advancing in spiritual enlightenment. Yes, that is the point. A bhakti community imparts factual advancement in spiritual enlightenment. When the devotees are part of a thriving spiritual community, they can taste spiritual enlightenment happening amongst themselves. And they're enlivened. Krishna consciousness, bhakti, is not just some theory, some religious belief. That's what everyone is afraid of. During our programs in Footscray yesterday, we assured the people, you're not going to be just saddled with a religious belief. Instead of the demigods, now you're going to believe in Krishna. We've got a new belief for you. And remember, in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, Mata Prasadam Nanya, there's nothing superior to Krishna. Take this belief on top of the ones you already have. Of course, the audience will be very polite and respectful because, after all, Krishna is one of the gods. So, you never know, he might help you pass your exams or get PR. So, but we are not just distributing beliefs to people. We are giving a chance to an opportunity to be part of a community of vibrant spiritual enlightenment where they can actually, with their senses, experience the Krishna reality, the supreme reality.
We hear from the purport that the devotees are fully satisfied with their progressively more beautiful experience of Krishna consciousness. Now, if we don't have that, whose fault is it? It means we are not applying the process properly. So we should be honest. We may need some help. Just like students need some tutoring, we may need some help so that we indeed are fully satisfied with progressively more beautiful experience of Krishna. Bhakti is not static or stagnant. It's always moving forward. More Krishna, better Krishna. Because Krishna is ever increasing in beauty and attractiveness. It's not that Krishna was imperfect before and he's moving toward perfection. No, Krishna's perfection is eternal and ever increasing in the beauty, in the sweetness. So as devotees, if we're performing the process properly, we experience that. And it's especially easy to experience that in the vibrant community of devotees. That community is so important these days, even from the material point of view, because people are so lonely. So the community of devotees solves the material loneliness problem as well as imparts spiritual experience. The spiritual experience of the devotees can become so intense. That's why we're attracted to hear about Krishna's pastimes, particularly in Vrindavan. They show the pinnacle of intense spiritual experience. Sanatana Goswami explains how in the palaces of Dwarka, Krishna was glorifying his dearmost consorts in Vrindavan. And his submissive wives, like Rukmini, they appreciated, yes, those cowherd girls of Vrindavan, they are superior in their love. As the queens of Dwarka, our love for Krishna is merged with so many social duties and social responsibilities, social obligations. But the girls of Vrindavan, they have no support from social duties or ritualistic duties. Their love is just love for Krishna, that's all, without any rituals or prescribed duties. Therefore, they are superior. Rukmini, Krishna's chief wife, and other submissive wives, they thought like that. But Satyabhama, she has a different approach in dealing with Krishna. And her approach gives Krishna pleasure. How does she give Krishna pleasure through her approach? By being jealous, by being unsubmissive, by being angry at Krishna sometimes. An ordinary man, of course, he would hate to have such a wife. Isn't it the male dream to have a wife who just does what you want even before you say it? Isn't that so? Just like the ladies are dreaming of a husband who knows what they feel even before they feel it. Satyabhama's way of giving Krishna pleasure is by being unsubmissive, feisty, jealous. But she does it to give Krishna pleasure because Krishna is the supreme enjoyer. He can handle it all. He can enjoy it. He can enjoy having an unsubmissive, feisty wife. And then Krishna enjoys calming her down. In material existence, it's a great austerity for a man to have to deal with a woman when her mind's out of control. Although the men don't, well, they do say it, but they try to control themselves. They learn not to complain about it, just take it as part of life. They don't like it. It's a great austerity to have to listen and then correct. It wasn't like that. And there's no point in bringing up something that I did 25 years ago. And haven't we discussed this at least 15 times before in the past year? So actually, men don't relish pacifying a woman who's, you know, sees there's a problem. But Krishna likes it. He's got the skills. He has the ability to enjoy even that situation. And therefore, he has Satyabhama. She creates a stir, and then Krishna has to pacify her. But he enjoys that as part of his romantic abilities. So in this way, we can easily see we are not the Supreme. And Krishna shows he's the Supreme in that he can masterfully relish even that kind of situation, which for an ordinary man, for a tiny part of Krishna, is just unpalatable. So, Satyabhama, she was angry. Krishna's glorifying the gopis. And she hid in her chambers. And Krishna knew about it. He ordered, bring her here, bring her here. She was thinking, well, it's my relationship with Krishna to be feisty and unsubmissive, but maybe this time I went too far. Just like Brahma in the Vimohana Leela, Brahma took the cowherd boys and the calves away, but in a split second of his time, he was thinking, oh, maybe I went too far. So he came back a split second later, which, as you know, happened to be a year of earth time. So Satyabhama, while she was being summoned by Krishna, she was thinking, maybe I just pushed it too far this time. In this way, she's actually showing humility. A devotee is always thinking, how can my service to Krishna be spot on? So she was analyzing her service. And maybe I was just a bit too jealous, even though it's my nature to be jealous and to give Krishna pleasure in that way. Maybe when it comes to his glorifying the gopis, I should have been quiet. This shows how a devotee is introspective. Even in the spiritual world, the devotees are introspective. How to constantly improve the service to Krishna. So Krishna called her. Bring that daughter of, what's his name, Satyajit? He's the one who had a little problem in Dwarka. Krishna particularly, purposely called her the daughter of Satyajit. In other words, your father had a bit of a problem, remember? And your behavior is causing me to remember that. What was Satyabhama doing? She was hiding behind a pillar. She was afraid to come directly in front of Krishna because by her introspection, as we said, she was thinking maybe she had pushed it too far this time. So she didn't come. She was there in the big chamber of the palace, but she's hiding behind a pillar. But how did Krishna know she was there? Of course, Krishna knows everything. But what is enlivening for the devotees is to understand how Krishna knows everything. Simply knowing everything doesn't mean the topmost enjoyment. Krishna doesn't let his full knowledge get in the way of his pleasure. So the way he knows things in a particular situation is the way of the best pleasure for him as a supreme enjoyer in that situation. So how did he know Satyabhama is present in the chamber of the palace? There's a particular beautiful fragrance in the room right now. That can only mean Satyabhama is here. Come out, come out. So she presented herself before Krishna. And then Krishna began to explain to her, there's nothing as dear to me as these devotees in Vrindavan. If these devotees in Vrindavan say that I should renounce everything, I promise you I'll do it. Meaning if the Vrindavasis say that I should renounce my palaces in Dwarka, my queens, my children, my wealth, I am prepared to do that. You should understand. You would think that Satyabhama would be devastated, right? She was jealous of the cowherd damsels of Vrindavan. And now Krishna is saying, if they want, I'll renounce everything here in Dwarka. But actually, Sanatana Goswami explains that Satyabhama was feeling encouraged because Krishna was confiding in her in that way. This is how the emotional exchange works. Well, he's revealing his mind to me. If he didn't care for me, he would have never revealed such a confidential thing. So the fact that he said such a thing to me means he trusts me. Let's see how the intricacies go. What man in the ordinary world can handle all those intricacies? No way. It's just too trippy. But Krishna knows how to handle it. So he said such a bold thing to Satyabhama. At the same time, she felt endeared to him because of that. He was taking her into confidence. Then Krishna quoted Lord Brahma in the 14th chapter, 10th canto of Bhagavatam, prayers by Brahma. He says that my mind is just short-circuited. I'm totally bewildered thinking how there could be any other reward for someone other than Krishna. Krishna is the embodiment of all benediction. He is reward personified. How could anyone think that there's any other reward to have? Yet, look at the situation in Vrindavan. Krishna has given himself so fully to Putana and her relatives. What is there left to give to the Vrijvasis? In other words, Krishna is so indebted to the residents of Vrindavan. So Brahma is using as a measuring standard the fact that Krishna gave himself to Putana. She became a nurse in Goloka Vrindavan. Qualitative status as Mother Yashoda. Krishna delivered her relatives, Aristasara, who's the other one? Bakasara. The whole family of horrible demons, they came in contact with Krishna. So Brahma is saying like that. If that's what Krishna does for Putana and her hideous family, what is there left for him to give for the residents of Vrindavan? In other words, Brahma is expressing Krishna's indebtedness, his eternal indebtedness. And Krishna's quoting that. Yes, Brahma has said that. He's telling Satyabhama, it's true. I am always indebted to them. And then he begins to give a beautiful explanation of the situation of viraha bhava, separation, the ecstasy of separation from Krishna. He said, don't think that if I would just be present before the residents of Vrindavan, that the whole situation would be resolved. Their acute pain and agony of separation would be taken away. No, it's not so simple. The fact is that if I would go back to Vrindavan, if I would give them my audience, the situation could very well become worse. And here's why. Krishna said, number one, as soon as the residents of Vrindavan, particularly the gopis, as soon as they see me, they just lose track of the world. They lose track of their bodies. They lose track of everything. In this way, they can't function anymore. This is what my presence does when I manifest before them. So, in other words, the whole town of Vrindavan shuts down. People lose track of the world. I don't want that to happen. Therefore, that's one reason why I shouldn't give them my darshan. I shouldn't appear before them. My presence has such an effect on them. Secondly, the pain of separation that they've been going through is so intense that if I suddenly appear before them, it'll be like a shock. Their systems can't handle it. Sanatana Goswami gives the example of someone who's been fasting a long time. You can't suddenly give them a full banquet of food. You have to gradually introduce food to them. It takes a long time. Just like when we have an all-day fast into the night, Gaur Purnima,
Janmashtami. Technically, you're supposed to first take some breakfast, some lemon juice or grapefruit juice with some black pepper in to stimulate your stomach, to prepare it for the food, for the prasad. So Krishna says, like, it's like that. I can't just suddenly go back to Vrindavan. It'll be such a shock for their systems, which are so worn down to they're resembling a death-like condition, these Brijvasis. If I suddenly appear, their systems won't be able to handle it. In other words, I would have to spend a long time with them to gradually revive them in a holistic healing way. But Krishna says, I actually don't have time to spend a long time there. I have a lot of things to do. Therefore, for that reason, it's better I not give them my darshan. And actually, there's another reason, he said. Even if I give them my darshan, if I give them that spiritual experience, the maximum peak spiritual experience of meeting me, they'll be fearing separation. Of course, in Krishna's explanation, we find out that the maximum spiritual experience is Vrahabhav. That's why Krishna says, I'm not going back, because he's indebted to them, therefore he has to give them the best thing, which is love of Krishna and separation. This is hard for us to understand. I've pointed out before, if you have a husband or wife who's very dedicated in their service to you, and the mutual duties and the commitment over so many years, and then what are you going to say? My dear wife, I cannot repay you for all your service over 20, 30 years. Therefore, there's only one thing I can do. I'll leave you. But Krishna does that. He's expressing his indebtedness to the residents of Vrindavan, particularly the gopis, and saying, there's nothing I can do to repay them. Therefore, in other words, I have to give them the greatest thing, which is love of me and separation. That's the real reason why Krishna doesn't want to go back. He's given them the best thing already. So then, he says, even if I was there with them, they would be overwhelmed by the anxiety of being separated from me. The example given is of the queens of Dwarka. In the last chapter of the 10th canto, chapter 90, the queens of Dwarka, they point out, they give the example of a kuri bird. Oh, listen to your lamentive cry. Listen to your mourning. You must have had Krishna's presence. And then he disappeared. We can understand that. Now, actually, the acharyas point out, when the queens of Dwarka were speaking like that, when they were expressing their feelings of separation from Krishna, they had just been with Krishna playing water sports just a few moments before. But already, they're expressing their anxiety of separation, even though they've been with Krishna. Night hasn't come yet, but they're presenting their prayers as if night has come, and they're feeling separation from Krishna because Krishna's asleep. But actually, it's daytime, and they've just been playing water sports with Krishna. But they're feeling the acute separation from Krishna even while he's there. So that's the reason Krishna gives. What is the point of me going back to Vrindavan? Even if I'm there, they'll still be overwhelmed by feelings of separation. These intricacies of the topmost experience in bhakti may seem difficult for us to understand, but still there's an extraordinary sweetness to them. And the fact is that the Vrahabhav, the feelings of separation that the residents of Vrindavan felt, was so strong that it brought about, those feelings brought about Krishna's physical presence. That's the mystery of love of Krishna and separation. So Sanatana Goswami
explains that, look at the case of Dhruva Maharaj. Under the guidance of Narada Muni, he was doing his spiritual practices. He was chanting Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya, and he was doing his Ashtanga Yoga. And he saw the Lord in his heart. He was meditating on the beautiful form of the super soul in the heart. Then, at the mature time of his yoga practice, that form of the Lord in the heart disappeared, and Dhruva opened his eyes, and he saw the Lord outside him. The Lord had come as Krishna Garba to reciprocate with Dhruva. So, before that mature moment, in other words, there was a difference between Dhruva seeing the Lord inside and seeing outside. But for the most advanced devotees, the residents of Vrindavan, particularly the gopis, there was no such distinction between seeing the Lord within and without, because they are on the pinnacle of spiritual advancement. We can all say that we have seen Krishna. Don't feel shy and intimidated if someone challenges, "Have you seen Krishna? Are you seeing Krishna?" I was just in Los Angeles, and I was walking down the street where the temple is situated on, the temple community. And one devotee, in a very challenging way, he came up to me. "Excuse me, Maharaj, I have a question for you, and would you please answer honestly?" Remember, you're a Maharaj, you have to be honest and straightforward. I said, "Please ask what question you like." "Do you see Krishna?" I said, "Yes, and you can also see Krishna." "Wait, excuse me, Maharaj, do you see Krishna?" I said, "Yes." "Maharaj, I told you that as a sannyasi you should be straightforward." "You should have integrity." In other words, I didn't give him the answer he was looking for. And then I wasn't straightforward. So I explained in class the next day at New Dwarka, everyone is seeing Krishna. There is a difference, though, in the level of intensity of your seeing Krishna. But even these children here, they're seeing Krishna. In Bhagavatam class, you are seeing Krishna through the ear. When you look at the deities, you're seeing Krishna with your eyes. It'll take a while to get over the imagination that you're just looking at stone, but gradually that awareness will dawn upon you. You all are highly intelligent persons. Do you think that simply out of religious belief you're going to bow down before stone statues? You have some experience that there's something special going on in terms of the deities. You feel it. You experience it. You may not understand it fully. You won't say that you have full realization, but even a newcomer, even a new devotee, experiences, "Ooh, when I walk into the temple room, there's something special." And of course, even these little children, when they take prasad, they are seeing Krishna through the tongue. There are no doubters at prasad time. Everyone's a full believer. "Yes, this is Krishna." And you're right. So you're seeing Krishna through your tongue. You're seeing Krishna through your ear. You're seeing Krishna with your eyes. You're smelling Krishna, the flowers and incense offered to the Lord. Bhakti is a full sensory experience. It's just that there are different levels of intensity in seeing Krishna. We don't deny that, because there are different levels of intensity in love. In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, "Rasaham apsukontya," I'm the taste in water. So if you, when you're drinking water, think, "This is Krishna, he's the taste," you're seeing Krishna. It doesn't mean that you are seeing Krishna the same way a topmost devotee sees Krishna. Nevertheless, you are seeing Krishna. It's all about intensity. Love is all about different levels of intensity. So Sanatana Goswami is describing the topmost intensity in loving Krishna, where even when Krishna is not present, the feelings of separation, the varaha bhav, actually make Krishna physically present. It's a mystery. So every one of you is seeing Krishna. And as you mature in bhakti, the intensity of your seeing Krishna increases. So we are not theoretical believers. And certainly we don't waste our time wondering, speculating, is the world real? Is it not real? We know, janmadi asyataha, the world emanates from Krishna. Because Krishna is the supreme real. Even the dreamlike material existence is also real. All right, we'll stop here and ask any questions. Yes.
Maharaj, you mentioned that at the process of birth, death and birth, that the mind's conception of self is totally eradicated.
Yes, because in illusion you're thinking, I am those sense objects. They're so dear to me. You define your life in terms of sense objects.
So, from the Gita, we understand that there's actually like a fragrance left over that carries us from one to the other. So it's like a hint. And that conception of self is like a hint of where we're going next. It's like total.
No, you're not looking at things through the viewpoint of the Gita. You're looking through the viewpoint of illusion. The sense objects are gone. I'm finished. As a conditioned soul, you're not going from body to body thinking of Gita knowledge. You understand? In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna's pointing out what's actually going on. But in illusion, we're thinking, the sense objects have been yanked away from me. That's death. And then you're in your new body with new sense objects. Mother and father are there. You're being breastfed. You're getting little toys. Ah, I'm alive. Sense objects. And you totally identify with them. So Krishna is explaining this in Bhagavatam. It's not contradictory. Krishna is explaining that in illusion, the soul thinks that when the sense objects are finished of a particular body, bodily stay, then the person's identity is finished. In other words, a person is so illusioned, he or she's identifying with the sense objects as the self. Particularly, try to understand, particularly the experience of interacting with the sense objects. It's so dear to us. We're so invested in it. It's embarrassing to think about. So Krishna, very brilliantly, in the most genius way, is giving you a different way of looking at birth and death. It doesn't contradict all the other ways. Catch yourself next time when you're interacting with sense objects, how you feel lively if they're pleasing sense objects. Yes, this is life. This is what it's all about. There's a false sense of intimacy created. The Sanskrit term is called jiva kosha, in which you hallucinate an intimate relationship with the body and its sense objects. You know the saying, cozy and snug as a bug under a rug. You actually feel that in relation to the body and the sense objects. It's a false intimacy. So that's what Krishna is talking about in this chapter. Anything else? Yes. And the mind is influenced by your karmic activity. Yes.
Like you were mentioning that we are all seeing Krishna through our ears when we are Bhagavatam, or through our eyes when we look at the baby, or through our tongue when we are looking at Krishna. So as devotees over the years, we do all these things, but then it starts becoming mechanical. We know the philosophy that yes, Bhagavatam is all looking at some Krishna, but sometimes how do we keep that intensity or that enthusiasm that is inside us that this is Krishna or eating Krishna?
Everyone heard? How do we keep that enthusiasm? That here's Krishna. How do we avoid becoming mechanical? Well, I was just thinking, now that so many of you you're living in the Western world, in the days of old, when people in the West considered marriage to be important, and they got married, what did they do when their relationship began to become dry? They would go on what's called the second honeymoon. Has that phenomenon hit India yet? They would do something to revive the romantic flavors. They would go to the place where they spent their first honeymoon. 20 years later, they would go again and try to revive the juice of the relationship. It hasn't happened. These things hasn't hit India yet, huh? It's probably just the idea of some businessman, you know, trying to get more business for his holiday spot or resort area. Second honeymoon, that's a great concept, will spread throughout the world. But we can learn from that in devotional service. We can go on a rejuvenation program. Get deeper into the selfless service. That'll do it. As soon as you selflessly serve Krishna, the old magic comes back. And you become inspired to selflessly serve Krishna by hearing about Krishna. Just become non-mechanical. Dance in kirtan and ecstasy. Put your heart into sacrificing for Krishna. And because it's your original constitutional position, you'll feel revived. If you'd like to know more about how to handle this situation, I've tried to give some realizations in a book called Bhakti Bhava, The Emotions, the Emotional Dynamics of a Devotee. So I try to do a little service by dealing with this point. Anything else? Yes.
In relation to the question how people ask why did they ever forget a previous birth, and so what if people ask why did they reject, some people remember previous birth, how would we answer that?
They remember a little bit. That's all. But they don't remember everything that happened in their past life. Huh?
So why does that happen?
It's just the interactions of the modes of material nature. Sometimes you get a little glimpse. I died in World War II when my airplane crashed. All right, so what are you going to do about it now? Maybe you died in the Korean War and you took and then you took birth on another planet and then you were born here again or something. I know, you came from the heavenly planets. It's probably what Bhagavad Gita tells you. Anyway. In any case, what is so important about remembering just a little bit of your past life? Even if you remembered everything of your past life, so what? What are you going to do about the process of birth and death? It's like when sometimes when I'm in India, persons come up to me, Swamiji, Maharaj, please look at my palm. Tell me my future. You are a sadhu. Certainly, you can know my past and tell me my future. Please, especially I want to know what the future is. I can understand that the past is past and nothing to do about it, but tell me, look at my palm, tell me the future. So I say, okay, show me the palm. I look at it very carefully. I see that you're going to get old and you're going to die. They look at me. In surprise, I'm seeing the future. 500 rupees, please. But we want to hear something else. We don't want to hear about birth, death, disease, and old age. That's just an incidental, right? The main thing is wealth and comfort and sense gratification, respect, prestige. Let's hear about that. Those are the main issues. Birth, death, disease, and old age, we know. Krishna talks about it in the Gita. Those are side issues, minor incidentals. But let us consider the thrust for material enjoyment. That is the thing at center stage. This is our foolishness. So it's not so important that you get little glimpses of your past life. The important thing is, how are you going to engage in devotional service now? Go with the flow of devotional service. What does Queen Kunti say? May my consciousness always flow toward you, just like the Ganga is always flowing toward the sea. All right? Anything else? So, yes. We go where Krishna wants us to go, when Krishna wants us to go, for his service. It's not a point that's under our control. Krishna is arranging the devotional service of his devotees. You agree that at some point, he would have to go, right? At some point, you'll have to go, I'll have to go. Right, so for a devotee, it's all arranged in terms of devotional service, the departures. And he'll go on in that capacity. He'll increase. We are here for Krishna's pleasure. Of course, we miss devotees more than words can say when they leave this world. But they're serving Krishna. We're not here for our pleasure. We're here for Krishna's pleasure. Still, it's a fact. When the associates of Lord Chaitanya began to disappear, the remaining associates, some of them wanted to commit suicide, like Raghunath Das. He wanted to go to Govardhan and jump off. But his guides assured him that he has service to do in this world. So we stay or go depending on devotional service. Krishna had plans for him. I'll give an example from Vrindavan. There, in the 70s, six-year-old daughter of a devotee, she had mental problems. And she was in Vrindavan with her parents, and she managed to find a rubbish bin, and she dug deep into the rubbish bin and found at the bottom a bottle of pills, and she swallowed all the pills and she left this world. So Prabhupada was there at the time. He pointed out, obviously this is Krishna's arrangement. What is this, a 5 or 6 year old girl who's even mentally impaired? She finds a big rubbish bin and gets down to the bottom and pulls out a bottle of pills. It means that her time in material existence was up. Prabhupada explained that. It means that in her past life, she almost went back to Godhead. And therefore, in the present lifetime, she only just needed a few more years in this world before Krishna said, okay, your time is over. Come back to me. I know another example of a daughter of devotees. They were celebrating Prabhupada's Vyasa Puja in Detroit Temple, the Fisher Mansion. And the daughter, she was just 4 years old. She was dancing most ecstatically in the kirtan. And then she disappeared. You know, the devotees didn't notice during the kirtan that she had left. And then later they began looking all over the temple for her, and they found her face down in the swimming pool of the temple. She had drowned. So she had left the kirtan, dancing in ecstasy, and just started walking on her own through the temple. It's a big building, which due to the previous ownership has a swimming pool, and she just walked right into the pool. But the mother understood. She's gone back to Godhead. One minute she's dancing most ecstatically, remarkably ecstatically in the kirtan. And then she disappeared from the kirtan. She just obviously had a few more years to spend in the material world. You know, it's not so great being here. In case you haven't noticed, it's not such a great thing being in the material world. So we miss the association of such devotees. But let us not think that it's so great being here. All right? This is Kali Yuga, so materially speaking, the lifespans are shrinking. That we don't see so many persons living 100 years. People don't expect it. But for a devotee, it's different than these material measurements. For a devotee, it's up to Krishna. A devotee lives and dies for devotional service. Okay? And that devotional service is eternal. The devotee is eternal. Srila Prabhupada also physically left us. So you listen to Aindra Prabhu's kirtans, you'll always feel his presence. Last question, yes.
Even though we have this lifetime doing a few devotional service, the missing part will be the next life, because it is too much.
Someone repeat the question, please.
Even though we are doing pure devotional service in this lifetime, the relishing part will be in the next.
The what part?
Relishing.
No, relishing now. When you're taking prasad, you're not relishing? When you're dancing in kirtan, you're not relishing? You should have seen yesterday the devotees who worked hard to arrange the programs. They were relishing. We have tried to please Krishna. We've tried to do our best. There's a taste to that. They were relishing. And during the kirtan afterwards, they were jumping and they were very happily displaying to the new people that we are part of a thriving devotional community.